Moses has been called by God from within a burning bush of all the ways and places that one would expect for the call of God to come. I guess that just tells me that God can use any number of means to get our attention. Some things we might predict and some things we might not, but there in the wilderness, a bush is burning and it's not burned up, and God speaks to and calls out Moses. Living in the land of Midian, now 80 years old, God has heard 200 miles away a cry of his people, and he's called Moses to go back to Egypt and lead his people finally to the promised land, a promise that God had made to Abraham a long time before, that he would have descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky, and that they would occupy the promised land. And that second promise has not yet been fulfilled, but God hears the cries and the moans of his people, and so he sends Moses back. I've often wondered why Moses? Why Moses? I mean, we might wonder that a lot of things about God. Why does God put on certain person's heart or call in their lives to serve in one way or another? Well, only God knows, but we do know that Moses lived outside of Egypt for 40 years. I've wondered if that might be the reason, that maybe the Hebrew children who were back in Egypt, maybe they were so subjected to the gods of Egypt and the influences of the culture, and maybe God, I just wonder about this, that God put Moses in isolation, if you would, for 40 years. And so when he came back, he was coming back into coming back to his home, but maybe not coming back to a place that he had so much of an influence by. But God calls Moses to lead his people out. The book of Exodus tells the story. We're studying in the book of Exodus. And tonight, we look in chapter 4, Moses returned. Well, tonight I want to look in Exodus chapter 4. Moses returns to Egypt. And tonight the text is really about the journey home and just a few things that happened that is recorded about what happens after Moses gets the call and he makes a decision, yes, I'm going to go back to Egypt. And so tonight we look at the end of chapter 4 and just a few things that happen on the way for Moses. So turn in your Bibles, if you would, to Exodus chapter 4, and we're going to read verses 18 through the end of the chapter. Exodus chapter 4, beginning reading at verse 18. Then Moses went back to Jethro, his father-in-law, and said to him, "Let me go back to my own people in Egypt to see if any of them are still alive." Jethro said, "Go, and I wish you well." Now the Lord had said to Moses in Midian, "Go back to Egypt, for all the men who wanted to kill you are dead." So Moses took his wife and sons, put them on a donkey, and started back to Egypt. And he took the staff of God in his hand. The Lord said to Moses, "When you return to Egypt, see that you perform before Pharaoh all the wonders I have given you the power to do. But I will harden his heart so that he will not let the people go. Then say to Pharaoh, 'This is what the Lord says, Israel is my firstborn son, and I told you, let my son go so he may worship me, but you refuse to let him go, so I will kill your firstborn son.'" At a lodging place on the way, the Lord met Moses and was about to kill him. But Zipporah took a flint knife, cut off her son's foreskin, and touched Moses' feet with it. "Surely you are a bridegroom of blood to me," she said. So the Lord let him alone. At that time, she said, "bridegroom of blood," referring to circumcision. The Lord said to Aaron, "Go into the desert to meet Moses." So he met Moses at the mountain of God and kissed him. Then Moses told Aaron everything the Lord had sent him to say, and also about all the miraculous signs he had commanded him to perform. Moses and Aaron brought together all the elders of the Israelites, and Aaron told them everything the Lord had said to Moses. He also performed the signs before the people, and they believed. And when they heard that the Lord was concerned about them and had seen their misery, they bowed down and worshiped. The first thing that I notice about the story tonight is, once again, the role and the influence of a man named Jethro. Although we only see a little bit about Jethro and his influence on Moses, Each time we hear something about Jethro, and there's really, I think there's four references to Jethro that are in the book of Exodus, and each one of them shows something about the depth of relationship that took place between Moses and Jethro. Jethro played an important role in Moses' life. He came into Moses' life at what may have been for Moses the lowest point of his life. He had fled Egypt. He was a murderer. Pharaoh had vowed to kill him. He flees across the desert. He's sitting down at a well. And very soon he meets Jethro. And Jethro accepts him. And Jethro gives one of his daughters, Zipporah, to him in marriage. And it looks like from this story and a story that comes later in the book of Exodus that Jethro is more than just a man who provided shelter for Moses. Jethro has become a mentor to Moses and apparently a man who had great influence over Moses. We know that Jethro was a priest of Midian. We really don't know what that means. At least there's not really any other evidence in the scripture of what Jethro and a priest of what and a priest for who and what did he do? We really don't know, but we know that his influence over Moses was very important. We also know that Midian was an area that was settled by a descendant of Abraham. So presumably Jethro also was a descendant of Abraham through a different line, a different family line. But here you are eight generations later from Abraham and you have Moses and you have Jethro. Well, Jethro takes on that role and takes on an important role in Moses' life. We see six words from Jethro tonight, but they show us and tell us something about his relationship with Moses. Well, by now, of course, Jethro has been Moses' father-in-law somewhere up to 40 years. It could have been a lot less than that. We're not told when Moses got married after he met the family and the seven daughters of Jethro. But Jethro had given to Moses one of his daughters, Zipporah, in marriage, and they were married. And by now, Moses has a father-in-law, and Jethro becomes the grandfather of his children. And so maybe they're close in just those natural family ties and so forth like that. But also there seems to be a greater length in an influence that Jethro has over Moses. Obviously, Moses respects Jethro greatly. And I say that, one little evidence that is he goes to Jethro and asks for permission to leave. Now, maybe because he's married to his daughter, maybe there's cultural expectations, maybe there's more to the story we know about, but Moses does show deference to Jethro. And after God tells him to get up and go to Egypt, what does Moses do? But he goes to Jethro, his father-in-law, and he tells him the story. I mean, we don't know what all he told him, but he says, let me go back to my own people in Egypt to see if any of them are still alive. He tells them, I mean, that doesn't tell us that he told him the whole story, but later on we do find that Moses has told. Jethro knows the story. Jethro becomes a part of the entourage of Moses at one point and supportive of him. He asks for permission. Not only does he ask for permission from Jethro to go back to Egypt, you imagine what that's like. You're taking my daughter where? From that place that you left as a murderer and you fled from 40 years ago and you want to take my daughter and my grandsons back there? You just imagine how Jethro could have responded. Again, we don't know a lot about the story, but just reading between the lines, we hear that Jethro is very supportive of Moses. He's supportive, it says, of Moses going back to his family. In other words, Jethro is family, but Jethro has an influence over him. Very simply, we read, what does Jethro say to him? As I said, six words from Jethro to Moses when he finds out that God has called him to go back to his people. Jethro says six words, go and I wish you well. In other words, Jethro gives a blessing to Moses, a supportive blessing. Yes, my son, go back to your family. Yes, my son, it's okay. Yes, my son, take Zipporah and the children and go back to your family. Jethro doesn't seem to show any fuss or anything other than support for Moses, and he'll always show support for Moses in the stories that we see. So, you know, if we just wanted to dwell on a sermon about being a father-in-law, Jethro would be an example to do that and relationship with with his son-in-law. Jethro was a blessing, and later he'll be a blessing to Moses as well, as Moses is swamped under and overwhelmed by the needs of this calling that God put on his life. And so by now, Moses has a family, his wife Zipporah, and two sons, Gershom and Eleazar. We don't know exactly how much time was in between those two sons being born. Gershom seems to come very early in the family, at least from the context, and Eleazar seems to come later, closer to the time of God's call on Moses. Again, we don't know exactly, but there seems to be a large gap of time between those two sons that are born to Moses, so much so that Eleazar apparently is called a boy anyway in the story. And if they had been married for 25 or 30 years, that's possible. Or maybe they didn't get married right away. But whatever the case, Gershom came first. And a long time later, a fair amount of time later, the second son, Eleazar, is born. It would seem born much closer to the time of God's call in Moses' life. In fact, it seems like there's something else going on that we get a bit and a piece of in the story that's related to this second son and related to the faith of Moses, related to the calling of Moses and what God had told him to do. Well, another important dynamic that I want to just notice from the story tonight, something that is important to Moses. It will be important as soon as he gets back to Egypt. It will be important as he talks to Pharaoh. It'll be important as he talks to the people. It will be important through the plagues and through them getting up in the night and leaving and going to the Red Sea. And over again, this is a very important part, and that is that God had said to Moses, "What is in your hand?" The staff of Moses, and how important this is to who Moses is, how important it is to the story. It says simply at the end of verse 20, "And he took the staff of God in his hand." So Moses, he's got his family, they've got their donkeys, and what is recorded that Moses takes with him? The staff of God, the staff of Moses, and how important that is to Moses. It would become so key to who Moses is. It would become key to fulfilling his calling. It is key to him representing God and the authority of God. So that when Moses goes into Pharaoh, he's not going alone. He's got the staff. And that says, "I have been sent by God." It represented something. It also was a tool that God put into Moses' hand of great power. And so that through that staff and in that staff, God supernaturally gave miracles that Moses was able to do. He first learned when he threw it down, it became a snake and he took it up. And God would use that staff as a great resource for Moses all the rest of his life. That staff is so important. It represented the miracles of God. What is that in your hand, Moses? We never know what God's going to take and use in our lives and make it into something more than it is. I mean, figuratively, we think of this piece of wood, this staff, and how, who would have thought that that could have become so important in Moses' life? But it did. And God can use things in our lives and give them meaning and give them purpose and use them to help us, to bless us, to encourage us, to guide us, that we might not ever think about. But for Moses, it was a simple staff. He had used it many, many times as he shepherded, many, many times as he took care of the animals. And for those 40 years, he had been using that. And God uses that staff in a mighty way in Egypt. Again, the power doesn't come from Moses. The power comes from God. And God chooses to use the staff, through the staff, so that his power was seen and known. Just think of all the times that that staff was used, usually for good, the plagues and the pronouncement. I'm thinking of another time when Moses struck the rock instead of speaking to it, and the power that was in that staff. You know, I just see the picture of Moses standing there at the Red Sea, and whatever it really looked like, you know, we have Hollywood's version, but you just see this man standing there with a staff in the air and the waters parting and them walking through. But the power of what that represents, the power of God. And so the staff goes with Moses, and he took the staff of God in his hand. And then we see that God gives to Moses, before he gets to Egypt, a preview of what's going to happen, a preview of what's going to take place between him and Pharaoh. For one thing, God tells Moses that he's going to perform many miracles. He tells Moses ahead of time. He said, Moses, hang on. That staff in your hand, I'm going to use that, and I'm going to perform great and amazing things in Egypt before Pharaoh. And so, number one, God tells Moses that he's going to perform great miracles. God did a couple of them already for Moses. I think of the miracles. Number one, the burning bush. Number two, throw down your cast and it became your staff and it became a snake. And God's already shown him his power. Moses believed it, but then God told him, and it's going to happen in the future. Part of the training of Moses, maybe when he saw that burning bush, maybe when he saw that snake, was God was showing him that now you're going to do that. You're going to use that staff, and great things are going to happen. He also tells Moses that your job is to go and confront Pharaoh. I mean, that had to be a big task. The Pharaoh that was in power when Moses was a younger man and he murdered the Egyptian, and it says that Pharaoh sought to kill him. Well, he's gone. He's dead, whether it's his son or who it is that took place. And so it would have been a next generation. It might have very likely been a Pharaoh that was about the same age as Moses, although we don't know from the scriptures. It would have been somebody closer to Moses' age, and maybe someone that he grew up with. It's very possible that the Pharaoh that was in power when Moses went back was a little boy. He might have played with Moses. He might have known him as a boy. But Moses is going back, and God tells Moses ahead of time that you're going to go back and you're going to talk to Pharaoh. You're going to warn Pharaoh. You're going to tell him my plan. You're going to tell him that God says to let my people go, and you're gonna deliver the messages to Pharaoh, but then God says, but I will harden his heart. I began to read about the number of times that term is found in the book of Exodus. Many, many, many times is the term harden your heart, and I understand that of the many times that term is in the book of Exodus, about half the time it seems like the reference says very clearly, God will harden his heart. And other times it says he hardened his heart. I don't know that there's a thin line between God hardening the heart of someone and man hardening their own heart and God using the circumstances in his life. And we're going to look at that as we get further into the book of Exodus. But very clearly, God says, Moses, you're going to warn Pharaoh, you're going to tell him, but he's going to harden his heart. He is not going to respond to you. And we know, especially the first five plagues, it says clearly, if I remember the references, it's Pharaoh hardened his heart. Then after that, God hardened his heart. Whatever it is, God tells Moses now that Pharaoh is not going to respond to what you tell him. Maybe he's trying to tell Moses, don't think this is going to be quick and easy. This is not just going to happen as soon as you go there and you say, tell him to let my people go. It's not going to happen. It's going to be a long process. And then we have again the words of God to Moses about the future, and he talks about the firstborn. He relates Israel, the people in Egypt, as his firstborn son. God says, they are my firstborn, and I want you to go and tell Pharaoh, let my firstborn go. And Pharaoh's going to harden his heart, and he's going to be warned over and over and over again, and finally God is going to take his firstborn, Pharaoh's firstborn. So even far before we have the story of the 10th plague and the blood that's put around the doorpost and the angel of death that passes over Egypt. Far before that, God has already begun to prepare Moses for what's going to happen. He knows what Pharaoh's going to do. He knows about the hardening of his heart. And so all this God gives to Moses the night before he leaves, or as he is leaving from Midian and going back to Egypt. I imagine what a hard story that would have been for Moses, if he did indeed understand it, and he knew. Maybe he was just beginning. Maybe God gave it to him to Moses because he was just beginning to understand what was going to happen and how this was going to impact his life and what he was called to do. He shows no hesitation to do what God tells him to at this point. I mean, Moses is in it now. I mean, he's gotten over that crisis of excuses, that crisis of God pick somebody, I can't do it, please don't ask me to do this. And he's finally come to the place that he does it, and he hears what God says, and it's like Moses has turned and he has set his face toward Egypt, and God's now telling him things, bits and pieces on the way and as he goes, to prepare him of what is going to take place. Well, then we have this story that seems so unexplained, and we don't understand, I don't understand the full context of it, and it's one of those stories you're reading on in the book of Exodus, and you read three verses, and all of a sudden you go back and now what did this say? And this is the story where all of a sudden, after God calls Moses, and they go through this excuse making and God providing. God gets angry when Moses says, pick somebody else. And God, he relents and, well, I'll call your brother Aaron and he'll help you do it. And then Moses accepts. And what happens? And Moses gets ready to go. And they start out down the road. And then in a matter of one verse, we read that God's going to kill Moses. I mean, what is this about? Is God capricious? You know that word? Is God all of a sudden changed his mind about using Moses? What do we make of this story? It really is an interesting to me story. I'll just read again these few verses. At a lodging place on the way, I mean they're on the way to Egypt, the Lord met Moses and was about to kill him. Wow. What could have happened between leaving Midian and on the way to Egypt, that the Lord is about to kill him? It's one of those stories that you got to read it a few times and think about. Suddenly, it seems to us. I mean, when I read the story, it seems like, wow, God, why all of a sudden is Moses the wrong man? What is it that's happened here? So we read the story and we read between the lines. Obviously, there's some things that we see in the context of the story. And there's probably some things about this story that we may not really know or understand. And it might be partially culture or things that we don't know. But we do know that the story is about circumcision. It is about, in part, the circumcision of Moses' son, his second son. We talked before about Gershom was born earlier and Eleazar was born later on, maybe closer. Might have still been pretty young at this point. We don't know for sure. But it seems like this sudden change of God's heart has to do with the circumcision of his son. I think that the story must be about, it seems to me, and if you read it or you sense something from it, I would love to dialogue about it too, but it seems like it's about God's justice and God's honor. It seems like there's something that's going on in this story that God has said, I said this is the way it's going to be, and you haven't done this. You haven't obeyed me. You haven't done what I called you to do. I don't know if this little boy came to a place that he had not been circumcised and God had been dealing with Moses about it. God maybe had been reminding Moses about it. I don't know about that, but somewhere along the way, this boy has never been circumcised. We don't know why. We don't know if it has to do with the culture of the Midianites. I don't know if Jethro's culture believed in circumcision. Some people believe probably not. Probably Zipporah was opposed to circumcision. And so whenever the subject came up in the family, maybe Zipporah said, I don't want this. Why are we doing this? And And yet Moses knew that he was a descendant of Abraham, and it was clear about the covenant with Abraham. And Moses knew that he was supposed to do this, and he didn't do it, and he didn't do it. And again, we're reading between the lines, but it seems like God's justice and honor and the heart of Moses is at stake here. Moses, are you going to do what you said you were going to do? Are you going to do what we decided on and we agreed? And all of a sudden, it seems like God is about to step into this picture after the burning bush, after the call of Moses, and God's just going to squash it all right there. He came to kill Moses. He met him on the way. If God said, okay, Moses, today's the day, and you have failed me, and it's over. I mean, it clearly says that God was about to kill him. I think of it as God is counting down. Maybe he was angry. You know, we think about the anger of God. God does get angry. And there are places in the scripture that show us the anger of God and what God is angry about. And when we think about that, God did at times, especially in the Old Testament, but also in the New Testament, God's anger came out suddenly. And he struck down different people. Ananias and Sapphira, we think about in the New Testament. God struck them down. You know? We think, well, God, weren't you being a little impatient? You know, God is God. And what offends the heart of God, we might not see God and think about his anger, but God is angry. He's angry at pride. We read that this morning. And other scriptures that I could have quoted this morning, God is angry about some things that man does. Now, God's anger doesn't last for a lifetime. And we know scriptures about his anger, but God does get angry. Maybe God was angry at Moses and he came down and he was about to kill him. And it would seem that it's likely that what's at stake here is the covenant. And God had made a covenant with Moses through Abraham. And circumcision was important to God. And again, so far away from that, it's hard for us to really understand and feel the importance of circumcision. I mean, we read about it, but we also know that in the New Testament time, there is a shift away from circumcision for the Gentiles. And baptism becomes what we think of as the symbol in the New Testament, what circumcision was in the Old Testament. And maybe we would liken it something like this. If you would come to faith in Christ, and you know that God said that you're supposed to be baptized, and you've heard the claims of Jesus, and you've heard the New Testament teaching, and you say in your heart, I'm not going to do it because I don't want to do it. I don't want to do what God tells me to do. At some point, if that's the attitude in that heart, there comes to this meeting of the will of man and the will of God, and we make a decision. Do we do what God tells us to do? It would seem it was something like that with Moses and his son. And it was of paramount importance. Perhaps it was of paramount importance because if Moses kind of lived in this gray area and didn't do what God called him to, what would happen when he went to Egypt? And he led the people out and then they started doing it. And that's really what part of the issues were in the Old Testament people. They did what they wanted to. They didn't always listen and do completely what God said. And part of the idea of the law is God said, obey completely. There's no substitute for obedience. And maybe God was saying with Moses, I picked you and you have all the potential in the world, but if you're not going to obey me, then I can't use you. And we'll have to come up with another plan. I don't know if that's what God was thinking or not, but clearly he was ready to kill Moses. It had seemed that Moses had been disobedient. Whatever that was, it would seem that way. He was disobedient. Maybe you would say he was lax. I mean, it could be that I can't imagine it's a matter that he forgot. I mean, it's pretty big for that. It would seem more like he was careless, or maybe worse. Careless, maybe rebellious. Maybe there's something in Moses that said, I'm going to do it my way, and I'm not going to do what God said. And so much so that God had decided after all this to take his life. Right on the road back to Egypt. Boy, what a picture of a failure of God's plan. I mean, all this work with a burning bush, all this discussion with Moses, and God was going to end it all. You know, there's stories in the Bible that raise more questions and sometimes answers, and this is one of them. I don't know that I got this story down, but it's in here, and it makes me wonder. Obedience. How important is it to God? God knows the heart. God knows what's inside of us. He knows what we really care about and we feel. God knows the heart. Well, according to this short three-verse story, his wife Zipporah steps in and saves Moses. She grabs the flint and she circumcises the boy, and then she lays the flint at the feet of Moses, touches his feet symbolically, maybe symbolism of touching Moses and saying, Moses, this is what is right. Maybe it's true that Zipporah had fought it all along. I don't know if that's true or it's Moses. Really don't know, but some people, commentators think, well, this was Zipporah who said, God, if it's this important, don't kill Moses. It's my fault anyway. And she takes a knife. Or maybe she just sees the weakness of her husband and she says, oh, Moses, I'll do it. And she does it. I'm not sure what, but then she lays the knife at Moses' feet, symbolically, I believe. And God relents. What a story. Curious to know what you think. Maybe later talk to me about it. But God relents. He's on his way to take Moses' life. And Zipporah steps in and does what she does and lays the knife down, and God stops. And he backs up. Think, wow. What do you say about Zipporah? Will our actions impact and affect what God will do in judgment? Would the things that we do, maybe in the lives of people, have an impact on the heart of God? Makes me wonder that. I mean, whatever the case, whether it's Zipporah's fault or Moses' fault or combination, I don't know, but God stopped when Zipporah did that. Maybe it was just a matter of obedience, and God said, okay. I said, if you don't do it, it's going to happen, you know? Or maybe Zipporah, by stepping in that place, was pleading with God, God, would you overlook his sin? Would you overlook what he has done? And would you save him? I don't know what it is. But this story has more to it and more power than I feel like I understand and know right now. She stepped in and God relented. That's kind of part of the story that gets my attention. God relented. He spared Moses without any other discussion recorded, without any explanation, without any consequences. God spared Moses and he moved on. In fact, it's almost like it didn't happen. The next verse is, the Lord said to Aaron, go into the desert to meet Moses. Now, I don't know if maybe God did that after this, and that was the way God responded. He said, okay, Moses, you passed the test, or Zipporah passed the test, or whatever combination of who is right and wrong. But there's nothing that explains it. It simply says that God went to Aaron. He called Aaron and said, Aaron, I want you to go, and I want you to meet Moses. I don't know if Aaron had a burning bush too. Who knows? But here God pulls this man out of Egypt, who's roughly 80 years old too, and sends him halfway across the desert to meet his brother. God orchestrated that. God planned that. God called Aaron too. You think of this story? He called Moses out of Midian. He called Aaron out of Egypt. Then he had to meet halfway. He was already preparing Aaron. God was already speaking to Aaron too. Not only was he speaking to Moses, but he was speaking to Aaron too. There's some things that we know about Moses and Aaron. Obviously, they were brothers. They had probably spent their first 40 years together, so it's not like they didn't know each other. They did know each other growing up, and they were around each other, and they had spent many years together in Egypt. I don't know if they had had any contact through messengers in the time in between, but Moses and Aaron knew each other, and God called them together. This is part of God's plan. I won't say it's a part of God's first plan, but it's a part of the plan that God allowed. And so he spoke to Moses and he spoke to Aaron and he brought them together. The role that God gave to Aaron was to be the spokesman for Moses, the mouthpiece. You remember Moses had said to God in saying, God, I can't talk, I stutter, I can't do this. And God kept saying to Moses, I called you to do it, I called you to do it, I called you to do it. And after God got angry with Moses when Moses said, pick somebody else, says God was angry with Moses, and he said, what about your brother Aaron? God said that. So I believe when I think of this story and I think about Aaron, that Aaron was not God's plan originally. It was God's second best plan, but God allowed and God chose Aaron to step in and to be a part of that. So what do we say about that? Well, he's a spokesman, and he will be with Aaron for the next 40 years, roughly. Basically, Aaron and Moses become linked together in the work that they do, going out to Egypt, speaking to Pharaoh, leading the people out, instructing the people, speaking to the people, speaking to God, speaking to Pharaoh. Aaron is always there in the middle between Moses and those things. God did provide a helper to Moses. As you know, and if you know the rest of the book of Exodus, sometimes Aaron was a great hindrance to Moses. In fact, Aaron in many ways drug down the ministry of Moses. Maybe he did a lot of good things too. Obviously he did, but he also had some character flaws and character issues. I believe Aaron was God's second best to Moses' lack of faith. You know, when we fall short of what God wants, it doesn't mean necessarily God's going to give up on us. But sometimes we get God's second best. And if we choose not to trust him and have faith in him that God sometimes gives second best, it doesn't mean that he's over with us. They would become partners for good or for bad. Actually, there's three of them that really become linked together over time. Well, Moses is on his way, Aaron is on his way, and they meet in the middle in the desert. And God puts these two men together. They'll spend the next 40 years together. They become partners. They become linked together. Actually, three of them become linked together, because when they get back to Egypt, there'll be a third member of the family, Miriam, the sister, who also becomes a part of this three-person leadership, if you would, of the Israelites. Miriam, in her own way, and again, in her own weaknesses and in her own failures, and she and Aaron were both a part of some of the painful and ugly things that happened after they came out of Egypt, and the lack of faith, and probably being influenced by the gods of Egypt and the worship of those gods and the golden calf. And you know, we think of those stories ahead and how Aaron and Miriam were a part of that. And maybe that's why God had called Moses instead of Aaron to lead the people out. But they do become linked together, those three, Moses, Aaron, and Miriam, for many, many years, up to 40 years at this point later before they're all dead. So when they get back to Egypt, the end of chapter 4 tells us the work begins. And simply in verse 29, we see the picture of what happens. Moses and Aaron brought together, I'll read, all the elders of Israel. And when they heard that the Lord was concerned about them, they bowed down and worshiped. I just put a little bit of each of those verses together in that because I wanted to emphasize that tonight. It says here, Aaron told the people and brought them together. And when they heard that the Lord was concerned about them, they bowed down and worshiped. And finally, the people heard from God and they heard the words of God. God did not forget them. God cared about them. God was concerned about them. God had heard their misery. And it says that the people responded. When they heard that, when they knew that God cared about them, then they bowed down and they worshiped. And thus began this relationship with God. They become the people of God. They've been the people of God in God's eyes, but they haven't seen that or felt that or known that. But this is the beginning of a journey. And of course, a journey with some good chapters and a journey with a lot of difficult chapters too, as they begin to respond to the call of God to be his people that would lead them out of Egypt and lead them through the Red Sea and lead them to Mount Sinai and the Ten Commandments and the law that would be the basis of relationship between them and the people and the descendants of Abraham forever. And so they're back in Egypt, and we'll end tonight there.